You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Okay, thanks everybody for coming to the internet panel to end all internet panels. Actually, I don't think that's true at all. I think this will probably just be the beginning. I wanted to also mention just a bit of housekeeping. There is a networking lunch that begins right after this panel with the Honorable Bob Goodlatte and Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber. So if you get up to any interesting conversations, you can just keep those going right over to lunch, and it should be all very exciting. My name is Casey Ray. I am the Deputy Director of Future of Music Coalition. We are a nonprofit research, education, and advocacy organization based here in D.C., but with our tentacles all over the place. Very small organization, very interested in these issues. Personally, I'm a musician. I'm a music fan. I use all of these new whiz-bang services, very excited about the developments in the marketplace, and I happen to be a policy wonk, so I'm just going to stay out of the way and listen to what these eggheads have to say about these issues. This is a vast and complex topic, the internet and music, and we could be here all day. As a matter of fact, my own organization has had something like 11 conferences, I think, on any number of these topics. So I'm going to be relying heavily on these guys to kind of power through. Just as a bit of background, I'm sure by now you know a lot about the story of music and the internet. Once upon a time, there were physical albums, record stores, over-the-air radio broadcasts, and that was pretty much how you encountered and accessed and purchased music. And then one day, the entire marketplace was upended, rattled to the foundations at least, by peer-to-peer file sharing. And that led to a decline in brick-and-mortar stores, so on and so forth, but also the rise of new technologies and a legitimate digital music marketplace. And we've seen on the download side stores like iTunes, eMusic, and Amazon MP3. And also the development of a new revenue stream around sound recordings, which is the digital public performance right that is implicated by digital broadcasting. And that's a new addition to the sort of overall marketplace revenue pie that didn't exist even a decade ago. And that royalty is generated when sound recordings are streamed on any webcast station like Pandora. And there's also, of course, now listen-on-demand services. How many of you know Spotify, for example? Okay, great. And so this is called interactive, and it's music that you can choose the song as opposed to having the song chosen for you by either a webcaster or an algorithm. And so it all sounds really exciting. We now have that universe of connectivity, in ubiquity, and access across devices. The next step is probably the car dashboard. So we're living in this world of access and discovery with music, which is fantastic. However, it's not so simple. Depending on the type of use, music is licensed completely differently. And I don't want any eyes to glaze over here, but for example, internet radio like Pandora, which I'm sure we'll be talking about today, is governed by a government-issue statutory license on the sound copyright side, and a similar compulsory-style license on the publishing side, which operates under court-enforced consent decrees. Now, on-demand listening services like Spotify, like Spotify require negotiations with record labels, and that can be expensive, time-consuming, and uncertain. So we have a very uneven marketplace, and the question we're going to ask today is it functional? To what degree is it functional? And what responsibility does Congress have in helping to further the aims of a legitimate digital music marketplace? So all of these conversations and transformations, whether they're seen as progress or more disruption, have been made possible by the internet. And we're going to talk about net music, the role of legislators, and also get a little bit philosophical about where we think this thing is heading, not just in the short term in this Congress, but in the future. What do we want this marketplace to look like? How do we get there? How do stakeholders work together to achieve it? And all of our panelists have really important insights here, so I'm just going to stop talking and let them introduce themselves, because if I tried to do it myself, I would make an utter mockery of their CVs. So we could start over on this end and just go through some introductions and briefly describe what brought you to this conversation.
So my name is Jerry Brito. I'm a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I also teach law there. I think the reason I was invited to this panel, seeing as I'm not a digital music expert, is because I have a new book. It's a new edited volume called Copyright Unbalanced, From Incentive to Excess, which presents sort of the free market case for copyright reform. Should I go ahead and give my my thoughts, or should I?
Yeah, I mean, very briefly, how do you perceive the marketplace, and, so, and what are your thoughts about congressional intervention?
I mean, very briefly, I think what we're discussing here today is sort of the role of Congress in digital music, and I think the role should be very limited. I think it should create rights for artists and for their assigns, and then create a level playing field, and that's it. Step out of the way. And I know that's easier said than done, but we have to think to ourselves, what is the purpose of copyright? Why do we have copyright? Well, we have copyright to address a market failure, namely that creative works are a public good that we think we wouldn't get enough of if we didn't have government intervention. Now, there are two ways that we can intervene. One is we can create a Department of Art, Department of Music, that creates the art, basically taxes us and then spends and by doing that. The problem with that, of course, the reason we don't do that is because it's very difficult to plan. How much classical music versus how much hip-hop do you produce? And how do you price these? So we don't do that, of course. What do we do instead to address the market failure? We create a property right. Why do we do that? Because when you have property rights, that allows for markets. And the beauty of markets is that you get the right mix of stuff and you get the right prices. So why do we then move to a system where we have compulsory licenses, where you have government bureaucrats setting the rates and doing so, especially Congress doing so, depending on which technology you're using. So that's sort of my blue sky vision of what Congress's role should be.
My name is Delita Costin, and I'm the general counsel of Pandora Media. And you've heard a little bit about us already this morning, but I think that I was invited here for one single purpose. As the general counsel at Pandora, I am very much aware that we are going to be before the Copyright Royalty Board starting really 1 year from now, as my friend David pointed out just a minute ago, asking for rates to be set before the Copyright Royalty Board for webcasting. And from my perspective, the standard under which those rates will be set, the willing buyer, willing seller standard, is one that's just fundamentally broken. It's a system that, for every single webcasting rate setting that has gone through to date in the past 12 years, has led to congressional intervention. It's not working. And when I stop and I think about the fact that we're paying over $250 million in revenues to Sound Exchange for calendar year 2012, and I think about the large economic impact that we have within the ecosystem, I really start to wonder and think, what's the best answer and the best solution for artists and for services, for labels, for everyone? And to my mind, the very first thing that we need to do is correct that standard so that we don't necessarily need congressional intervention going forward. It really is a flawed standard, and that's one of the reasons why Pandora supports it.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. I know many of you were probably out last night, so thank you for making it to their panels this morning. My name is Mike Huppy. I'm the president of Sound Exchange. For those of you who don't know what Sound Exchange is, we're the nonprofit here in D.C. that basically helps administer the statutory license that Casey referenced up top. Why were we invited here today? I think we were invited for a couple reasons. One, we represent the entire recorded music side of the market. We have over 70,000 artist accounts, over 25,000 record label accounts. So really, when you think about Sound Exchange, you should think about not just the artists, but the unions and the featured artists and the background players, singers and musicians, and not just the labels, but the major labels, the indie labels, the organizations that represent them. So when Sound Exchange is up here, we sort of the umbrella organization with over 90,000 accounts, all representing the creative side of really what we're all about here today. And I think we were also invited because we're in the middle of all of this. We are the ones who are at the CRB more than anybody. We are the ones who work with our good friends gathered here at the table to try to maximize what it is that artists get out of this great thing, this great new world we live in. And, you know, we're the ones that help enable the whole space. So I think we have a very important role in this discussion in terms of, I'm sure we'll be getting deeper, but in terms of Congress's role in the ecosystem and how they should work in that, I couldn't agree more with what was said before. As a general matter, market forces, when possible, are the best thing to drive progress. You know, the U.S. is a testament to that. When you let the market work as best as possible, you know, that is the thing that is going to allow the system to develop to its fullest. Now and then, that's not always possible, and there are cases where Congress does have to intervene, and they intervene in this space. But the best thing Congress can do is set fair and equal rules. I agree 100% with what was said before, that there are not fair and equal rules. You have a situation now where some people pay for streaming their music, such as Pandora, and some people don't, such as Over the Air. You have a situation where some people pay according to a fair market value, such as Pandora, and others get a below market subsidy, such as satellite radio. You have a situation where some recordings garner a royalty because they were made in 1973, and some don't because they were made in 1971. So the most important thing Congress can do is set a fair and equal playing field so that the rules are the same for everybody, and then business models can succeed or not on their own.
Hi, my name is Lee Knife. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit trade organization here in Washington called the Digital Media Association. We count amongst our membership a whole host of consumer-facing digital media companies, the likes of which are Pandora, Apple's iTunes, Microsoft's Xbox Music, Google, YouTube, all these types of consumer-facing media outlets. In that position, we actually deal with a broader range of music rights that Casey was talking about earlier. As Mike just said, Mike deals with specifically the sound recording right as it relates to non-interactive webcasting, which is exactly what Delita's company engages in. We happen to deal with the mechanical music copyright, which is the composition, the underlying composition. We also deal with the rights for the sound recording that go with Mike and his organization. And there's a whole host of things there. So even broadening on what Mike was saying a minute ago is not only are the rights striated within just the sound recording world, right, where a cable company pays under a different standard than a non-interactive radio company, but when you expand that out into the entire universe of music and you include the underlying copyright for the composition there, even those rights are further striated. It depends on whether the music is synchronized with a visual image versus whether the music is being mechanically reproduced, whether or not that reproduction takes the form of a digital distribution that may also be a performance or a stream, et cetera, et cetera. All of this is a far too verbose, I apologize, kind of foundation laying for the point that, you know, going back to what Jerry was talking about, the congressional intervention that we've had in this space overall, not only sound recordings but also the underlying music compositions as well, has just been completely jigsaw puzzle in nature. When you try to explain to somebody who's not in this industry exactly what it costs to either sell, perform, synchronize, or otherwise deliver a piece of music in particular, there's any number of rights, there's any number of ways that those rights get paid for, there's any number of ways that the rights that get paid for, the rate gets set. It might be set by free market, it might be set by underneath a consent decree. It might also not be set underneath a consent decree, depending on right, where we're going, right? And also whether or not it's a digital right, right? Because that's happening now, too. It might be set under a full statutory rate. So the overarching reason why I'm here representing DEMA is to basically make an appeal for, to the extent that there has to be congressional action, and taking a half a step back, we think along the lines of what Jerry said and what Mike said. Probably the least congressional interaction is probably best. Free market forces are, you know, when they work, they seem to work well. But to the extent that Congress has to be involved in this space, they need to stop engaging in technology-specific legislation that cordons off particular medium by which music or any other media is delivered. It shouldn't matter whether it's digital. It shouldn't matter whether I can see it or I can only hear it or I could only hear part of it or whether or not it came with some other product or service. The idea should generally be that music use deserves a royalty. Artists deserve to be paid. They deserve to be paid a fair amount. And to say that they should be paid something different from a cable company delivering a digital recording versus an internet radio company delivering the same digital recording to the same consumer just doesn't make sense.
Well, that's really interesting because there's a couple of, well, there's a lot we could tease out of that, Lee. Actually, I think you're, you know, a walking case study for the need for licensing reform, just in general, right? Licensing reform is something that is a buzzword that gets thrown around a lot, but nobody really knows what it means. Licensing reform for whom, under what conditions? And I think that the issue here is we know that copyright exists. That's what we're talking about. Copyright, in essence, is government intervention. It determines the rules of the marketplace to a large extent. There are exclusive rights that that attach to copyright depending on different uses. And really what we're getting down to here today is you have the concept of a compulsory license where a government can set a rate or establish a proceeding to consider evidence to arrive at a rate, which allows the music services to benefit from one-stop shopping. They don't have to ask permission for every single use. And in the case of SoundExchange, you know, there's a mechanism to compensate the performers and the record label simultaneously. And of course, there's another copyright associated with music, which is the publishing or the composition copyright. And it, too, has conditions under which it can be blanket licensed or so on and so forth. Although, as Lee mentioned, there's a mechanical. So what we're describing here is an incredibly complex marketplace where the technology continues to evolve, but we're still dealing with a lot of rules that have been ported over, sometimes, you know, ham-fistedly from an analog marketplace, and we're working to establish this fully functional digital marketplace where consumers can turn to all of these different platforms and services with a great degree of confidence to beat back this, you know, illegitimate marketplace that we've all been struggling against for years. So that's just my last attempt to try to, you know, put this into some sort of like conceptual package. I would ask a question. The current legislative controversy around the Internet Radio Fairness Act is basically not about whether there should be a compulsory license per se, but rather what is the standard that the Copyright Royalty Board, which is a trio of judges that arbitrates these proceedings, what is the standard that they should employ to set those rates? And I'm just going to ask all of you, and anybody can jump in, why the current rate is setting proceeding is either effective or ineffective, and what Congress could or should do about it.
Well, I'll jump in. So the Internet Radio Fairness Act was a legislation introduced in the last Congress. And in a nutshell, it had quite a few things in it. Some might call it a kitchen sink of legislation. But the headline issue that I think the leader referenced earlier is what are the rules by which these judges set the rates? So think about what the compulsory license is, okay? If you are a service like Pandora, you have the right from the U.S. government under this statutory license to stream every sound recording ever released and to make a business off of that. Think of that for a minute. You don't have to call a single record label. You don't have to call anyone on the recorded side. You file a two-page piece of paper with the Copyright Office, meet the terms of the statute, and boom, you're in business and can make a very excellent service, a very profitable business. Most of the services that use that option, their rates are set by the judges, and they are set according to what's called a willing buyer, willing seller standard, what we like to think of as generally a fair market rate, which makes sense. The government is forcing creators, artists and record labels, to surrender their property to companies like Pandora to go and build a business. The least we can do as a society is compensate those people at a fair market value. There are three. We have over 2,000 services that pay SoundExchange every month, over 2,000. Of those 2,000 plus, three alone pay under this older, grandfathered, below-market rate. And we believe that those three outliers should be brought up to where everybody else is and pay a fair market value. The legislation that Casey referenced, it tries to do exactly the opposite. Take the other 2,000 who are paying a fair market rate for the content that they're getting from the U.S. government and lower them down to where those three outliers are at a below market rate. And we just think that's fundamentally wrong and fundamentally unfair to artists who, after all, form the core of what it is those services provide.
What about the the question or criticism that you can't actually determine what a fair market rate is because there is no comparable market? How would you answer that, or would anyone else care to jump in?
I'm happy to answer, but I don't want to hog the panel.
Okay.
Anybody have any thoughts?
The way you determine it is the
thoughts and rebuttal. We'll do it that way.
The judges look to other market analogs. You know, the way these things work, the judges are trying to figure out what is this fair market rate in a situation where there's not really a market. So what the exercise becomes is let's look at things out there that are close and are actually out there in a free market and use them as a benchmark and then adjust accordingly. So if there's something that's more valuable because it has more functionality, it's actually negotiated in the marketplace, let's look at that as a representation of what this music is worth and then adjust it because the license that we're administering has a bit less functionality. And you hire economists and you know, some very complex experts. But they've actually, you know, it can be done, has been done. And, you know, I don't blame companies that pay for wanting to try to constantly lower the rates. But the fact of the matter is it's a thriving webcasting business that we have and a thriving webcasting market. Over 2,000 services entering the business and streaming today.
So, but I want to jump in a little bit here because, I think that you're right when you talk about the artists and how important it is to compensate artists. We at Pandora really actually have our DNA grounded within the artists. Our founder, Tim, started the company based on his own experience as a struggling artist, wanting to create a musician middle class. And today we have 100,000 artists, over 1 million tracks, and we pay our catalog, our catalog plays, 95% of our catalog plays every single month. So when you stop and you think about what that means, it means that there are 100,000 artists, 95,000 artists every month who are getting some kind of play on Pandora. And that's huge scale. And when you think about the royalty amount that it results in, it's $250 million for this year. And that's kind of the very beginning of this discussion. When I hear Mike talking about the willing buyer, willing seller standard and how it's worked, one of the things that I really start to think about is, you know, we know that, you know, from your testimony, 60 to 70% of the royalties that you're collecting from internet radio comes from one company. It comes from Pandora. So when you stop and you think about what the world would look like if this webcasting business were really allowed to thrive and there were actually more webcasters out there making up a larger pie and creating a larger pocket of a pool of money, there would be so much more revenue out there for artists. And that's something that we really believe is important to get to as we think about how we're going to proceed with Web 4. The willing buyer, willing seller standard, it doesn't work. It hasn't worked. And according to our calculations, when you think about the royalties that are paid into SoundExchange, 95, 96% of what's paid in isn't being paid in under willing seller, willing buyer. And a 95% failure rate is a failure rate. There are no other webcasters out there. You can talk about the 2,000 webcasters that are paying, but it's not under willing buyer, willing seller. And that, to me, is evidence that the system is broken, the standard is broken, which is why we absolutely support the bill, and we support the need for congressional intervention. It's Congress that got us here in the first place.
So it's pretty clear that that Pandora has done a lot to grow this marketplace. I mean, I think everyone would agree with that. For a lot of consumers, webcasting is synonymous with Pandora, and I think that's earned a lot of goodwill on the artist side as well. However, I would like to ask you if you know of any economic studies that would bear out your assertion that lowering that rate somehow or moving to a different standard would usher in new actors into the marketplace in any way that would offset the amount of money that was lost from lowering the rate or moving to a different standard. Do you follow the logic?
I think so. So one of the things that's true is that the Internet Radio Fairness Act does not mandate a rate.
Correct.
We're not requesting a rate. What we're requesting is that the rates be set under a standard that has worked in this country for 30 years. The willing buyer's willing seller standard has not. And the 801B standard is one that the record labels use as they're procuring content from musicians and from artists and from composers. We know that it works in some cases for the record labels. We think that it's the right standard, and it hasn't been subject to as much government intervention.
If we jump over to the publishing side, there's a little bit of news that broke just this week or last week. Sony ATV, which is, I think, the biggest publisher on the planet. Is that right? Huge, really huge. They have gone to a direct licensing. They're not, for certain uses, they're not going through performing rights organizations like ASCAP, CSAC, or BMI. They recently negotiated with Pandora a new rate. I think that was something like a 25% increase. That seems to be a willing seller, willing buyer rate, or like something that you can point to in the marketplace as acceptable to both parties, because that's what was negotiated outside of a consent decree environment. So it seems to me, I just want to know how you guys would be philosophically okay with that on the publishing side, but opposed to something similar on the sound copyright side.
Oh, there's such different structures. So on the publishing side, on the sound recording side, we have to go through the Copyright Royalty Board. And there's market agreements and there are benchmarks, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of the process that Mike has described. The publishing side works under a consent decree. And so, yeah, there are agreements that are out there. I would say that with respect to the Sony ATV deal and the news that's been announced, we were faced with the prospect of having to withdraw a lot of music, possibly from our catalog, and that's not something that we would ever do. It's really important to us that we allow our audience and our listeners to discover music that they love, and likewise that we connect those 95,000 artists to audiences who are going to love them and create fan bases for
them. So you guys would like a one-stop shopping ability under a compulsory or something like that, right?
We do like the idea of a compulsory license. It makes it a lot more efficient. You can't really go through with a million tracks and figure out the copyright owners for all of those.
So can I jump in here?
Yeah. I was actually going to ask you a specific question, but feel free to add to it. I don't mean to interrupt you on the way. But we have basically here Congress creating, if you will, its own problem, but they established this right in the mid-90s. And they're kind of obligated to consider what the rates should be under a process in the rate court every few years.
Sure.
How do we make that work better?
Sure, the board is, but Congress doesn't have any obligation except to fix this problem that they've created. And one way they could do that is to rethink it from scratch. And so, just to address something Michael said, that you can get a bunch of economists and experts together and decipher what should be the proper rate, the proper price. Well, if that's true, the Soviet Union would have worked, right? You can't just...
Wait, it didn't?
You can't just have experts and even look at analogs, even as close as they are, and figure that out what it is. You only get the real prices when you have negotiation in a free marketplace. So calling something a rate setting done by judges, but that it mimics the market is just...
But what about efficiencies? You would admit that it's incredibly inefficient to try to negotiate an individual rate for every single use in a context of, broadcast.
No. So you just made the point that Sony is now working outside of the performing rights organizations. As technology advances, the transactions costs are going to get smaller and smaller. And so somebody like Pandora, what Pandora is doing is asking for a different standard. You, too, should negotiate directly and not try to negotiate this through politics, trying to either negotiate it through Congress or through the Royalty Board.
Well, actually, they had done that previously. The Webcaster Settlement Act actually created the conditions whereby they could negotiate individually.
And actually, in the last webcasting round, Sound Exchange negotiated settlements with 95% of the marketplace in exactly the way that you described. This rate setting starts off with the ability for the services to get together with Sound Exchange or whoever else it may be and negotiate. And as a result of the Webcaster Settlement Act, we went into the last rate setting with almost everybody having negotiated free market deals. By the way, those are the free market negotiations that led to the rates that were set by the judges because they had a free market thing to look at.
Lee, what do you think of that?
Well, I was going to say there's a couple of things. First of all, I agree with what Jerry was saying about I believe the market would create these efficiencies. I think it's kind of a straw man to say, well, you can't go out and negotiate 50 million licenses with 50 million different copyright owners, whether they be songwriters or sound recording owners. Mike's organization exists as an example of that, right? I mean, you don't have a statutory mandate to be either the only collective that's collecting these rights. You just grew up and became, the number one player in the marketplace, right?
I like to think we do a good job at it. So.
Well, you know what? We're going to get to that, Mike. No, I'm just kidding. I think it's important to note, as we're talking about this, that a lot of people talk about these statutory rates and the rate setting standard and everything, and all of these disparities. And they talk about it in the context of, well, Congress intervenes when they see a market failure. And at least particularly in the case of sound recordings and the Section 114 license and the willing buyer, willing seller standard underneath it, that isn't the result of a market failure. That was a market that didn't exist, and it was anticipated, right? And this gets to the point that I was making that I think is highly analogous to kind of Jerry's position overall, is that you didn't have a situation where Mike's organization and Delita's company had a problem coming to terms over 5 or 10 years and they couldn't negotiate these rates, and so eventually somebody stepped up and said to Congress, there's a need here for a federal intervention to help this marketplace move past this center point that it can't get off of. Really what it was the creation of a right, and then instantly the fighting from interested parties on both sides of that, both copyright owners and the people who intended to use those copyrights, about exactly what would have to be paid and exactly how it would be paid. It's a classic example of, it's not congressional intervention because it was necessary. It was congressional intervention because interested parties started to lobby their particular interests. And that's the underpinning of all of these problems here. When you have people entering into those legislative formulative debates with a particular interest, right? If it happens to be a cable company in 1998, because there's not an internet radio company at that point, and then there's internet radio companies in 2001 and 2010, the whole marketplace is different depending on your perspective. And so the point is legislation has to stop catering to those particular interests that are in the room at the time. And to the extent that there is going to be congressional intervention, it has to be as technologically neutral as possible, as business model neutral as possible.
It sounds like you're saying that there wasn't market failure because there wasn't a market. Congress created a market and anticipates failure?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
I would ask you a follow-up question. Do you believe that there should not be a right attached to sound recordings transmitted over the Internet? There isn't a right attached to sound recordings transmitted over the air terrestrial broadcast, right?
You should ask them about that too.
Well, I was told to talk only about the internet or else they would do very, very bad things to me, but I don't think we can talk about fairness, broadly without at least noting the exemption that exists for terrestrial broadcasters in the United States. Much of the rest of the world, I would say the vast majority of the rest of the world, does compensate sound recording owners, labels usually, and performers for the over-the-air play of music. And I think that we have to actually, at least if we're going to agree on anything today, maybe we can get the panel to agree that the digital public performance right exists in part to make up for that fundamental inequity.
Well, you kind of started this by saying it was a follow-on question for me. So this is the way I would answer.
Oh,
that.
Did I?
I thought you did.
Okay, but, we'll go with
I'm
that.
I'm going to take the opportunity anyway.
Feel free. So
here would be my answer to that. Without actually answering the specific question of whether or not there should be an expansion of the right for a sound recording to have a royalty paid for it for an analog broadcast, I would say that the fact that the right was created in 1995, 96, whenever technically it was, and it only applied to digital broadcasts is, again, a perfect example of what I'm talking about, right? We can debate on a policy level, and I understand that that's not supposed to be within the confines of this discussion, whether or not the right that Michael's company collects for should be expanded to terrestrial broadcast or not. That's a separate policy question. All I'm saying is, if in 1995 we're sitting down and we've decided as a policy issue to create this right, I don't understand why you create the right and then you say, however, it only exists on the internet. You only have to pay Mike's organization and his constituents if you're broadcasting over the internet. And by the way, if you're broadcasting over the internet with these particular technological parameters attached to it, that just doesn't make any sense. So that's
now,
kind of my
answer. So Congress is basically, they had a hearing a little while ago called Music Licensing Part 1, which leads me to believe there'll be a Part 2, and I hope it's just as thrilling. They expressed, Mike was there. He can tell me if I'm getting this right. They expressed what I read as, or witnessed as irritation at the fact that they had to even deal with this issue. So, I think sometimes legislators use that as a threat, like, to spur the private marketplace to come to agreements, or else they're going to step in and fix the problem, and boy, won't that be worse. If they were to say this, if this Congress were to reconsider internet radio fairness or webcasting rates, what are the odds that they could get it right that would satisfy even the stakeholders at this table?
Well, it's funny you mentioned, because obviously the hearing was about music licensing, and the chairman mentioned some ideas that Congress may have in terms of how they want to deal with those issues. But you are absolutely right. The vibe in the room, the theme in the room, the tone of really the majority of the questions, from my admittedly subjective perspective, was really Congress saying, webcasting community, digital broadcasters, you have come here time and time again. Our side plays by the rules, right? We weren't necessarily happy with the last satellite decision that was out there. But you know what? We followed the rules that Congress set, and we took an appeal, and that carried its way out. We don't run to Congress after the fact and try to have them change the rules after the fact. It is not our side that runs to Congress every time they're unhappy with an outcome. All of the people running to Congress is the user community that happened in 2004 and 2008 and 2009 and last year. So, to be clear, it's not the case that we all think it's not working. And I definitely think that there was a tone in the room of Congress saying, you can't keep doing this. We set these rules. We had a big revision of the entire process in 2004, I think it was, the CRDRA, that reformed how this whole process worked. New judges, new evidence rules, new cost limits, et cetera. All of that was done because the webcasting community came forward and said, we don't like the old way. So we have talked to them, and we said, fine, we'll come up with a new system. So it was changed. And you know what? They continue to not like the outcomes, and they keep running to Congress. And that can't be countenanced. Congress needs to set the rules, and we all have to live by them.
So as the person, I think, who is on the side that maybe doesn't follow by the rules, what I can say is that, there are a few things here to keep in mind. The first is that the webcasting community that you're speaking about in 1995 was a really small community, and those webcasters are not here today. When you stop and you think about the amount of money,
you mean like Yahoo and AOL?
They're not doing this anymore.
They're streaming.
Those companies are not here. But let's.
Well, are we talking about pure play? I mean, there's different categories of webcasting.
I'm talking about pure play.
Okay.
But even more importantly, if we're the single largest webcaster out there, that to me is a travesty. What's really important is for this webcasting community to be able to grow and to expand, and for the chokehold that's on the technology and innovation to be able to come off. And if we aren't allowed to expand, and if the webcasting community can't expand, then the artists are going to lose, and the royalties won't keep coming in. So to the extent that webcasters keep running back to Congress, I would agree with you that there was a lot of frustration at the fact that Congress has to deal with this again. I think that's right. But I also heard from Chairman Goodlatte and from several others that they recognize the gravity of the situation and the magnitude of the situation, and they recognize that something is incredibly broken. So I look out, and I have a lot of hope, because I think that The congressional folks to whom we've spoken, and I understand that the sponsors are reconsidering introducing the bill, lots of the different stakeholders are starting to talk about it. I think that there is actually a real admission that something is fundamentally flawed and a need to fix it.
Well, would compromise be possible? If you're disagreeing about something so fundamental as the standard of evidence that is allowed at the CRB, do you think that, I mean, I'll just put it between the two of you, do you think that you could achieve compromise on that?
I think that compromise could always be achieved. And when you think about something like the standard, I think that lots of stakeholders did agree to a different standard once upon a time ago for the PRA. But once again, you know, for me and for the fact of Pandora, we're really here trying to figure out what's the right standard and how do we put in a standard that we believe isn't flawed for the next webcasting hearing and the rate setting hearing.
And I will say, you know, we actually view Pandora and others, just despite our energetic discussions here, we actually view Pandora and all of the other 2,000-plus services as business partners. You know, SoundExchange has almost as strong an interest in them, you know, succeeding as they do themselves. And we always prefer business solutions to solutions that are not business driven.
There's a third party.
But absolutely, make no mistake. You know who's not up here? Who's not up here are the artists and the creators of content. I mean, at the end of the day, with all due respect to everyone up here, myself included, none of us is indispensable to the music business. The people that are indispensable are the folks that create the music, the songwriters, the artists, the performers, the record companies. All of these services that we're talking about, all of these companies, they're there to help serve that content up to the users. This is about the people at the foundation of all of this. And the one thing that has to be observed through all of this is that they get paid fairly and equally, and they're not subsidizing somebody else's business model. That's just not fair, especially in a system where they are forced to surrender their content by the government.
As a moderator, I'm not supposed to have an opinion, but I would agree that, you know, the missing voice is definitely the artist. And one of the more profound things about the digital public performance right for me is that it facilitates direct payment to the artist, direct and simultaneous payment to the artist and the label. The artist's share is not held against their debt to the label. And that, to me, has always seemed like a major advancement in the distribution of royalties. Now, I would say there's another party that's also not at this table, and it's the consumer. And to tell you the truth, the consumer doesn't give a shit. It just, the consumer thinks that, you know, any of their devices should be able to connect to the internet, and, you know, very, very soon their cars and everywhere else, and they're supposed to be able to listen to whatever flavor of music they want. If they want predictive radio, they should be able to do that. If they want, on demand, they want that. Many of them, you know, the elephant in the room is, many of them use YouTube as a radio station, an on-demand radio station, which is under a completely different rubric in terms of a license or not license, and that's the, you know, the notice and takedown provisions in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which we will not be getting into today, or else we will never leave this room. But I just bring that up to say the consumer is still driving the train and probably will be for a long time. So do any of you have any thoughts about how to approach Congress, knowing that the marketplace is to a large extent going to be consumer driven?
I mean, you mentioned the consumers don't care. What they don't care about is what we're discussing here.
Right.
But I think consumers do want all the choices that you were talking about. And you were saying how Pandora is the number one outlet, and you'd like to see more competition. You don't get that by going to Congress and having the same kind of royalties set. Mike, you were talking about artists being forced to surrender their rights to others, and as a result, you want a fair standard. Why don't we get rid of that requirement, that artists be forced to surrender their rights, and make it a complete negotiation? And when you have those kind of negotiations, you're going to see new entrants who come in and compete with Pandora and create new services for consumers. And that, I think, will benefit everybody.
I mean, I think from our perspective, the compulsory license is how we built our business.
That's right. You want to be able to offer...
We've built our business. And so I know that we would not be able to go out and negotiate deals for a million tracks with 100,000 artists in order to play the music that folks love. There's just no way we'd be able to do it in a timely manner. And, you know, we get stories in at Pandora all the time from artists, all the time, who talk to us about how Pandora has enabled them to grow their audience, how it's enabled them to really, because of our data, locate areas that they have fan bases and they didn't know, and they get to go and they get to tour. And that to us is really incredible and really powerful. And a lot of the mission and a lot of our DNA is about enabling that connection between artists and their audiences and their fans. So from our perspective, a compulsory license is really, in so many ways, the most efficient way to make this work. It's also a vehicle for the artist to be able to be guaranteed about payment. Through the statutory license under 114, we pay Sound Exchange, and Sound Exchange pays 50% of every payment that we make out to artists. And that's something that we're absolutely aware of and absolutely cognizant of. And in a world of the music industry changing, I would caution artists, those of you who are artists in the room, to start thinking about your own agreements and start thinking about what the world looks like without compulsory licenses and without that kind of protection. But we love compulsory licenses for that reason.
So it's a protection for whom? For artists, that their music has to be used by Pandora?
It's a protection. If you go back to the very beginning of what the copyright tenants are all about, and if copyright is about making sure that the world is able to experience art and music and wonderful things like art and music, but also that the creators are able to be compensated, I think the compulsory license actually satisfies both of those things. We are able to make sure that music is played and there's a mechanism pursuant to which every dollar that we pay, 50% of it goes back to the creators.
Jerry, I would say that, you know, protection is probably important. I mean, you're talking about the ability to refuse a use, which is also an important part of copyright and definitely has its place. But one thing that a compulsory does is it offers leverage to a lot of artists who wouldn't otherwise have it, right? Not everybody can afford the type of representation that would get them a seat at the table in these negotiations. But Sound Exchange, for example, can represent the artist half of its, you know, client base in that regard. And there are other, you know, the PROs traditionally did that as well. So I think that there is probably a trade-off, but there's something in that trade-off that is an implied benefit for a broader class of artists. You don't have to be Beyonce to benefit from the ability to have that kind of leverage.
And I think you can have that kind of collective action even without a compulsory license. And the argument for compulsory licensing that says that we need to have it so that we have more access, well, then we should have compulsory licensing for everything.
Well, I mean, at the risk of whatever, you know, going another 30,000 feet up and whatever, sucking all the air out of the room as we do it. I think there's a distinction there, you know, theoretically there is a distinction between a compulsory license and just a blanket license. We see kind of an example of that, you know, between the PROs on the performance side for the composition versus the statutory license that Sound Exchange administers, or the 115 mechanical that record companies pay and my companies pay for the underlying composition. And it, you know, certainly the debate that we've been talking about here in particular regarding the Internet Radio Fairness Act has to do, again, very, very specifically with a rate-setting standard. It's so there's a difference between making sure licensing is efficient versus how much you have to pay for that license once you acquire it, right? And I think it's important, as you have an intellectual conversation about that, to not let those get confused, because in practicality they go hand in hand, but philosophically and academically they don't have to, right? You can have a statutory type license, you can have a, you know, consent decree type license without a compulsory element to it, theoretically.
Well, to I guess maybe simplify it, hopefully to simplify it, but at least to bring back the consumer again, you have this new marketplace that's developing around on-demand streaming, where you can actually choose the song you want to listen to, Spotify, Radio, Mog, etc. In order to bring one of those services to the marketplace, you have to negotiate, at least on the sound copyright side, with all the individual rights holders to get permission for those uses. There is no compulsory. Now, again, the consumer doesn't care about that, but it does actually end up influencing how many of those services can come to the marketplace and what types of innovations they can bring with. And that is, you know, you look at that marketplace and you could say, well, you know, maybe we only need one of those. Maybe there only needs to be Spotify. But if we're making the argument that part of the reason that we want to fix webcasting rates is so more webcasters enter the marketplace, well, wouldn't it make sense to expand a compulsory license as opposed to, you know, having it only apply to this one area, which is internet broadcasting? Just a question.
No, the fact that you have a vibrant market in that side, when you don't have compulsory licenses, is evidence that you don't want compulsory licenses.
But who doesn't want? I mean, the question is, you know, this would be a question that I'd ask Mike, but maybe not in public. I mean, the question is, if you really do want to beat back, you know, illegitimate uses and make the legitimate marketplace seem more appealing, then yes, you would want more products and services of those of the legitimate category to exist, right? That's something that we could probably agree on.
Yeah, I guess your question is, if there were more, the more legitimate options there are, the less problem piracy is.
Maybe. And what frustrates or allows for the, you know, the growth of the legitimate marketplace? Is it a compulsory license?
Well,
is it license governed by a consent decree? Is it individual negotiations? Like, what does it?
I mean, look, there was a time where people used to say that the industry was slow in coming around to have these services. I think that excuse went out the window a long time ago. I mean, there are tens of thousands, thousands of services out there, both that we administer and other services that we don't administer. I think there are quite a few options out there. I think the industry just launched a website called Music Matters, I believe, where people can go and find out all the panoply of the different models that are out there. So I don't know if I'm answering your question exactly, but I think the industry has responded with a variety of options.
Oh, it's exciting that there's never been more, you know, legitimate, fully licensed products and services out there for consumers, and I think the response is starting to, you know, develop on the consumer side. My question is really just even more fundamental than that. Like, what is going to grow that marketplace? What type of legal or policy structures are needed? I mean, because it costs a lot more money to obtain the licenses for streaming interactive services than it does to get to operate under the compulsory.
Yeah, and look, whatever you think of the compulsory one way or another, I mean, the fact of the matter is we talk about all these licensing challenges and how hard it is to get licensed. Not so if you want to start an internet radio station. It's a two-page piece of paper you file with the Copyright Office. That's
Which is
all
cool.
You have to do.
Right.
You know, and I guess my question to Jerry would be, I know it's fun to talk about, you know, how the market might be theoretically, but the fact of the matter is it's not a perfect market. Perfect markets don't exist anywhere on the planet, as best I can tell. There's not a single market that has, you know, no false rents or externalities or, you know, where there's perfect information instantaneously delivered so that consumers can truly make the best choice. I guess my question would be, you can't truly think that we would have the webcasting market we have in the absence of a compulsory license.
I mean, maybe there aren't perfect markets, but when you have congressional intervention in the form of compulsory licenses, it really messes things up. I think you do look at the interactive, and you see how you are able to strike deals, and you do have different competitors. You don't have one a dominant one, and I think that's a good model to look at.
You can strike deals over a period of 18 months if you're lucky by putting a whole bunch of cash up front and going through like excruciating, you know, Hong Kong venture capital rounds and giving up half of your company.
So you can do it. So markets don't have to be super easy in two pages, right? Markets have to be difficult, and you have to put some equity and some sweat into it. Yes, that's right.
So let me ask just a broad question to all of you, and then I think we'll maybe move to audience questions. What is the marketplace, the digital music marketplace, not just webcasting, but the entire kit and caboodle, look like in 20 years? Is it a utopia, dystopia? Why?
Who's going first?
I'll go quickly. Utopia, simply because the externalities related to the internet are just growing exponentially, and there's no stopping it.
I think it's a utopia, and the reason I think it's a utopia is because I can foresee a world where there is a lot of music being delivered to so many more artists through distribution channels that do not exist today. And when I think about what Pandora has been able to do in connecting people with music that they love and helping people rediscover music, when I think about the letters that we get in every single day from consumers, who are hearing music for the first time that they haven't heard in, you know, sometimes 20 or 30 years, I really welcome that kind of a future. And I do believe that that's what we're looking at for 20 years out.
I think utopia is a strong word, but I do think 20 years, we're going to be light years away from where we are now in terms of the distance that we're going to travel, because this trend, I mean, what the internet and really digital technology generally enables us to provide to consumers as an industry is really awe-inspiring. I mean, even 10 years ago, to think about how different the world was, and that 10 years is going to be 8 years, then 6 years, then 5 years. So 20 years from now, I think we're going to continue the trend. There's going to be more options and, you know, more business models that we're not even thinking of right now. So it's headed in the right direction. Utopia, I don't know, but headed in the right direction.
Yeah, I would kind of echo what Mike said. I don't know that it would be utopia, but it would probably be more utopian than what we're existing in now. I agree with what Mike said earlier about the idea that, you know, 10, 12 years ago, it was very, very difficult for fledgling digital media services to acquire licenses efficiently. And some of the stuff that you were talking about, that, you know, the whole idea of front end loading your deal, and that's the only way you're going to get you're going to get your rights. Some of that is going away because I think that rights holders realize that, as Jerry pointed out, you know, the market forces that are presented by the internet are insurmountable. They're not only undeniable, but you can't circumvent them. And so I think we're just generally going to have a marketplace that's going to be forced there. I think it's less than utopia because I think legal reform will always be slow to come. And unfortunately, I think the reality of special interests being able to get in the room and push their particular agenda will – I don't know that that's going away in the next 15 or 20 years. But, yeah, I see the licensing landscape getting a little bit easier to navigate, a little bit cleaner, and a little bit more level.
So you've heard it here first. Almost utopia, I think, is what we've arrived at. We have a microphone right here, so if anybody wants to be bold and stand up and ask these folks some questions, now's the time.
Hello. Welcome, 2013. I'm glad to see it starting off with talking about this. I just want to bring up, I have been on the internet since 1995 as a music company. I was actually part of one of the original streaming companies. AOL is still streaming because they just streamed one of my releases the other day. One of the things I'm most concerned about is that we keep putting ourselves in the digital sand because the rest of the world still trades both in physical and digital. And the only thing that I ever hear everybody talking about is the digital side of that. And as a distributor, and I know most of the other distributors, every one of them will tell you that the majority of what they still do, 50% on the major side, 70% on the indie side, is still physical. And what will be important is using new streaming services to help these bands pinpoint where they need to go. So one of the things that scared me the most about the Pandora or the Internet Fairness Radio Act was subsection 4, where it talked about any new streaming company that may want to go out and talk to some of the other artists could be precluded from it by this act. And I thought that was probably one of the most anti-competitive things I've ever seen. So if we're really going to have a conversation about changing the future, being anti-competitive is not the way to start. And so let's be honest, and let's also look at the baby in the bath, that physical music still exists, and we need to look at both of them because it can help, and the fans want everything, and we should give them everything.
We don't have anyone from SiriusXM here.
You know, one of the things that I can say is that, you know, my understanding from the sponsors and from other stakeholders is that anti-competitive language that you mentioned is being considered and may possibly be changed. But I think that the concern you raised is a concern that I've heard lots of other people raise as well, and I just understand from the feedback that that's been heard.
And in fact, I agree 100% with your comment, sir, and I'll there's an even a step further. One of the most ironic aspects of the bill, at least from our perspective, was the fact that it proposed that Congress direct the judges, the CRB judges, to minimize disruption in an industry. Think about that for a minute. This is state of the net. We have, you know, tech-savvy people here and outside this room. Disruption, I thought, was a good thing. Disruption is competition. Capitalism is disruption. And I think any time, you know, you set rules where judges are supposed to minimize disruption, it is another form of keeping the status quo, giving the benefit to the people who happen to be there. So I think we need to be very wary of anything that, you know, minimizes disruption, because really that's something that should be championed.
Hi. All talk about utopia got me thinking that we end on a good note here. So it seemed to me like
I don't know. David Oxenford's behind you, so I don't think that's going to happen.
Utopia canceled.
Well, maybe. I'm going to still strive for this, at least for a moment.
He's a friend. I'm just kidding.
I think I heard from everyone on the panel through the course of the discussion at least one point of agreement across the board, and so I'd like to just draw that out for a moment. And that is that as a business matter, as a legal matter, as a moral matter, the people who are providing the music deserve to be fairly compensated. Is that a fair statement that we all agree
on
that?
That's a fair statement.
Yes.
Great. That makes the rest easier to work from. Thanks.
Wow, cool.
Just kidding, Dave.
Mike, just one question. You were saying that you license about 2,000 services mm-hmm. under the Webcaster agreement, and only three of them pay the...
2,000 services pay us every month, 2,000
right,
plus.
Right, but you said only three pay at a below market rate.
Yes.
And I can't believe that's true, because you've got small webcasters who are paying at a rate that's different than the willing buyer, willing seller rate. You've got small broadcasters that are paying at rates that are different than the willing buyer, willing seller rate. You've got non-commercial webcasters that are paying different than the willing buyer, willing seller rate. And in fact, you said 95% of the webcasters entered into settlement agreements
right.
in Web 2 that avoided Web 3 because they're paying at different than the willing buyer, willing seller rates.
I think we entered in two settlements with those entities that would have been proceeding under a willing buyer, willing seller rate. So,
except they were entered into because the rates that were set by Web 2 were not perceived as being fair, and everybody had to run to Congress. Isn't it that you keep winning? That's the reason that the webcasters have to keep running to Congress, because the system is essentially biased on your side.
So I don't think – I would say we were not thrilled with the last satellite radio proceeding uh-huh. that the STARS won. We would have liked a higher rate. You know, that's a case where the judges, for instance, said if we were going to set a fair market rate for SiriusXM satellite radio, we'd have them pay 13%. Or in the neighborhood of 13%, something approaching 13%. I don't remember the exact words. It was something like that. But because of this below market standard, they took that down to 6% and then inched it up over the term to 8%. So we weren't particularly thrilled with that, but we didn't run to Congress saying we should change it. And as to the non-commercials or the college radio, I mean, here's the thing. The point of a fair...
Or the small commercial webcasters
yeah.
or
right.
the small pure-play webcasters or the small
right.
broadcasters, which...
The point of, you know, if you were a record company, right, and you were to go negotiate in the free market that we've talked about with, say, a college broadcaster, you very well might take into account the fact that it's a college broadcaster, that it serves an educational purpose, that, you know, the size of streaming isn't so big that it's going to cannibalize your other markets, that you respect helping to lay the foundation for these people in the future webcasting industry. So the fact that we negotiated certain rates with certain non-commercial entities under a willing buyer, willing seller standard, I still think reflects the market, because that's what would happen in a real market.
Okay.
You know?
My point is, it's not three services that are paying less than what was set by the Copyright Royalty
well,
Board.
We view it that way, and I think that's appropriate.
Hey, how are you? Michael Petricone of the Consumer Electronics Association. I have a question for Michael. So you use the 2,000 number as 2,000 services as an illustration. The digital music market is vibrant and competitive. Just out of curiosity, if you take out Sirius, if you take out Pandora, you take out cable radio, how much do you collect from the other 1,997?
I don't have the number off the top of my head.
Percentage?
If your question is a substantial part of what we collect from a handful of services,
right.
that is true.
Would overwhelming majority be accurate? Or?
We know that Pandora is between one-third and a half.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. I mean, and the reason in that very infamous exchange when I was testifying, we aren't actually permitted to disclose what people like, according to the rules that Congress set.
It's okay?
So, no, there's no doubt about it, but I don't think that really gets us anywhere. It's often the case that market leaders have a large market share, and you know, as the market develops, you have more people enter. So I won't deny that. Yes, the handful of services pay the majority of what we receive.
Hi, it's Greg Barnes with DEMA, and it seemed like as part of this discussion, we talked a little bit about the Internet Radio Fairness Act. And the whole debate about whether or not willing buyer, willing seller was the appropriate standard, or 801B. And I guess I wanted just to focus on 801B. And Mike, you kind of said that generates a below market rate. And
generally, it doesn't have to necessarily, but historically,
it has the potential of producing a below market.
Well, it generally has.
Right. So, which is kind of interesting because I know I think Delita pointed out, it's been historically used in the context of licensing mechanicals, music compositions under Section 115. But I guess I would ask the question, can we talk a little about 801B and why those particular criteria are appropriate as guideposts for the CRB, and why you think those particular criteria would produce a below market rate? Like, so can we talk about the specific factors and have that kind of discussion?
Why 801B is desirable, or would
there's desirable? Some say that the factors are desirable and it's the fair standard to use, and some have suggested that it has the potential to produce a below market rate. And so I just want to have a discussion. It's somewhat weedy, but to look at the four factors.
Great question. Who wants it?
Well, I mean,
what I can say about 801B is that when I look at the history of 801B and the standard, and the kinds of rates that it's produced, and the fact that it hasn't resulted in this kind of panel, this kind of debate, this kind of tension or congressional intervention, I look at that as a standard that works. And when I look at the history of willing buyer, willing seller, especially as a general counsel who's faced with the new webcasting rate setting proceeding, and I see the amount of congressional intervention, the fact that new legislation has been passed, when I read the legislative intent, when I read the testimony, when I read the history, I can see that it's fraught and it's fundamentally unworkable. And so from my perspective, just on a really, without diving into the factors, on a very high level basis, the standard that works, you know, you've mentioned for the mechanicals, a standard that has worked for 30 years is one that makes a lot of sense to me, as opposed to one that is fraught with all kinds of difficulties that we've been talking about for an hour.
So for, again, not to bore the audience, but 801B is this old standard that's been used, and it attempts to set forth a bunch of criteria that the judges should look at, and I don't have them memorized off the top of my head. It's things like fair return on investment, fair profit,
public interest.
Things like that. Mm-hmm. And some of those components in there are all good and are appropriate. Two points, though. One, it is absolutely the case. I just mentioned the last satellite proceeding before from the last term. It is absolutely the case that the judges said, here's the market rate, and because of that standard, they cut it almost in half. And, you know, forget the specifics. As a fundamental concept, I say to everyone here in this room, how can that possibly be fair that you're not paying someone a fair market rate when you're forcing them to surrender their property so someone else can build a business? How can that be right? So, and that is absolutely true. That's what happened in the satellite case and a lot of other cases. And secondly, when you start to try to list all the things a market might consider, you're heading down a wrong path. And Jerry, I presume, will agree. I mean, I realize you don't want to have a compulsory license at all, but the concept of Congress saying, well, this is what a market bakes in. When two people sit across from a table, here are the 14 things that they're thinking about. You're going to miss some. You're going to overweight some. You're going to put some in there that shouldn't be in there. It's just a bad policy. Rather than saying, you know what, the market is the best thing we have. There's no such thing as perfect markets. But to the extent you want to try to find the answer, look to market solutions. That's the best solution.
Can I I mean, can I just add, you probably can answer this and work it in, but just a quick follow-up question. Business models, do you think that 801B as it exists adequately takes into account differing business models? I mean, because obviously putting, you know, satellites in the sky looks a little bit different than setting up a webcast station. And should any standard actually get that granular about taking into account different business models? And all of you can take a stab at that.
No, I mean, I think that 801B, precisely because it takes into account different business models, shows you that it can be a tool, a political tool, to favor one interest over another. And we shouldn't have that. We should have a level playing field. And as far as satellite, that's, you're right. Satellites are more expensive than an internet radio station. And so maybe that should factor into decision about whether you should be broadcasting music over satellites or over the internet. And that should all be factored in. You know, you shouldn't get a free pass because you have higher costs. No, that's part of the market decision that you make as an actor.
But can you ever achieve fairness when you have asymmetry in the actual business model? Like, could Congress ever, if it wanted to, actually properly set the set the stage for CRB to do?
No, that's my point. You can't. So therefore, have a unified standard.
And so we just have to throw it all out then?
Yes, that's what I've been suggesting. And I realize that because you guys have been working with the system for so long, it's a little difficult to sort of step up and go blue sky and consider this difference. But no, I think that is the way that you should be thinking about it.
Can I, at the risk of continuing to burrow further and further in the weeds in the last couple of minutes that we have here, and a little bit to Jerry's point, but picking up on what Mike was saying, both immediately prior and throughout the balance of this discussion, when we talk about just general notions of fairness. And we talk about things like, you shouldn't be considering not disrupting a marketplace when you're forcing people to give up their rights and things like that. To split the hair even finer, I think one of the problems that you have, at least with the current application of the willing buyer, willing seller under Section 114 that relates to non-interactive internet radio broadcasting, is some of the procedural and particularly the evidentiary standards that come to bear. So, while we talk about things like just what's fundamentally fair about a rate standard, I think you also have to talk about what's fundamentally fair about how that standard even gets applied and how the judicial process unfolds with the application of the standard, whatever it is, whether or not it's willing buyer, willing seller, or it's 801B with its four factors. I think fundamental notions of fairness within this country dictate that judges that are charged with rate setting in a marketplace should be able to look at every piece of evidence that might be useful to them while they assess that marketplace and what the appropriate rate should be. And so there shouldn't be limitations on the evidence that they can look at.
That gets into a question that we didn't even talk about today, and we won't, but who decides and what their background is, what is the composition of the panel of judges. Let's get to this last question and then call it a panel.
Okay. Sorry to expand it even further after already going over so many points, but I'm a singer-songwriter and a student studying music industry, and I'm also from Switzerland, to give you a little context. My question is, how can the internet be governed by country when internet's accessible from everywhere? I know there are restrictions, country restrictions, but those can easily be passed. I've seen it done before, especially in Switzerland and other countries. So my question is this really a problem that Congress should be figuring out, or is it something more WIPO-related?
Well, thank you, and thanks for being a singer-songwriter. And Huppy is a Swiss name, by the way. The fact of the matter is the way it's working out now, so there's entities like Sound Exchange in different countries around the world, at least so let's just talk about the digital for a minute. And we have sort of agreed as a group around the world that no matter where a stream leaves, where it terminates is where the performance happens. So if you're listening to a British webcasting station that is streaming out of London, and it terminates in Nebraska,
that's a U.S. performance, and Sound Exchange will cover that, and vice versa. If U.S. services stream into a foreign country, kind of that country collects. So it's not a perfect system, but that's how we are starting to address the fact that there are no borders. But the problem is, you know, every country has its unique laws. They have different requirements. You know, some treaties apply in some countries and they don't apply in others. So we're not at the point yet where you can just have one worldwide system. I think there's still too much of the national law involved in all of this activity that you're still going to need to have national considerations.
I would just add to that a lot of it is actually driven by the artists or the artist organizations, like record companies and PROs and stuff, only because historically it's been a very, very territorial business. And so what you have is you have the same kind of difficulties on the front end of this, right, in the licensing side of it, in that you have this long history of all of these existing recording agreements, cross-licensing agreements and stuff like that, that up until a few years ago were very, very respectful of territorial borders. And that now then when you try to overlay them over what you correctly observed is this global kind of internet capability, you run into actual rights, contractual rights problems, because you have artists who say, I'm only contracting with this record company for these territories, or I'm only allowing these rights in these particular territories. And some rights organizations have reciprocity agreements and others don't. So it's a difficulty that's just bringing what historically has occurred over the last 50 years into the modern age as well.
Some countries have, for some types of delivery types, right, have additional layers of rights that aren't analogous to another country's. I mean, it gets very complex. You know, sometimes I pop up to Canada to go to Canadian Music Week, and I hear over and over again that, like, we don't have Pandora. Ah, you know, and it's basically at the end of the day, it's being able to hammer out agreements with a number of different players and their interests and their rights societies, their collection societies, and their rights holders and their artist groups and so on and so forth. It's very complex. We've got to solve the problems in the United States first, if we can, maybe, and then move on to the tough nuts to crack. Okay, I think we're going to call it a panel. I'd like to thank our panelists here. It's a really fun discussion, and thank you guys for coming out.
Thank you.